Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
End up discriminating against those who are same-sex attracted, because you're going to end up treating gay people differently than you treat straight people, because they can come and get counselling for anything they want, straight people, but gay people can't get it if they have a predetermined outcome, even if they choose it.
You are causing, without wanting to recognise it, such deep trauma and harm, and it is spiritual abuse. I know it's done in love, and it's because you think it's the right thing to do, but it is harmful and wrong, and you must be held to account.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome back to the show. A really important issue being debated today, a bill to ban so-called gay conversion therapy. I'll introduce my guests in just a moment. Unbelievable, of course, the place for conversations that matter, and going long today, so we'll just have time for a few of your emails at the end of the show, but we do love you to get in touch. You can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I'll be giving out the other ways to connect with the show later on, and telling you about some conversations I've been having on other people's podcasts too. By the way, we've a new website coming soon for Premier Unbelievable, but if you want more from the show right now, our newsletter, ways to support us in 2022, and more besides, all available from our show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Right now, let's get into today's show. Today on the show, we're asking, should gay conversion therapy be banned? My guests are Peter Linus and Jane Ozan. The UK government has recently published proposals to ban so-called gay conversion therapy and a consultation seeking views from the public. In fact, the deadline is the 4th of February. The proposed legislation may also cover regulations around what kind of therapy can be offered to people experiencing gender dysphoria as well. And similar legislation was recently passed in Canada. So, should such a law be welcomed or be a cause for concern for churches and Christians in the UK? Two different perspectives join me today. Peter Linus from the UK's Evangelical Alliance has concerns about the scope of the legislation and the possible criminalisation of certain kinds of pastoral care for same-sex attracted people in churches that may take a traditional view on sexuality and gender. Jane Ozan is one of the leaders of the Ban Conversion Therapy Coalition. She believes this is an essential piece of legislation to help ensure that LGBT people are protected from harm in religious settings. Do please be aware that today's show covers sensitive issues regarding the pastoral care of LGBT plus people in the church. So listener and viewer discretion is advised. Peter and Jane, welcome along to the show. We'll start with you, Peter. Maybe you could just give a brief outline of the legislation that's being proposed, perhaps even a definition of what gay conversion therapy may encompass. And then just a brief sense of your overall reaction to this proposed legislation.
Well, thank you, Justin. And hello again to Jane. It's great to be here. And it is good to have an opportunity to have a kind of fuller conversation on conversion therapy. Jane and I have engaged before, but it's often in very short kind of form in a media context. So the government committed to end or ban conversion therapy a number of years ago. In fact, it was Theresa May, and then Boris Johnson's taken that on. We've had the National LGBT Survey. And then it became clear legislation was coming. We actually wrote to the Prime Minister in, I think it was March of 21, saying we were deeply concerned about practices that have been carried out under the name of conversion therapy. And we were recognising the role, the sad role the church had played historically, potentially in perpetuating stigmas and discrimination and harm. But at the same time, just flagging some of the concerns that we had and where it was signposting the legislation was going. We got a reply. In fact, it's the only letter I've ever had from the Prime Minister. I managed to spill coffee all over it. That's my stained coffee letter from the Prime Minister. And he indicated that he did want adults to be able to receive appropriate pastoral support and prayer in religious settings. He didn't want to criminalise everyday activity. And so we saw in the Queen's speech then in May 21 this announcement that they would end coercive or abhorrent practices around conversion therapy. And that's something that we would support, and we were clear on that. They brought out the consultation, as you mentioned, in October 21. They went for the shortest consultation possible. They've actually then extended that to the 4th of February, and it does include both sexual orientation and gender identity. One of the key problems you asked about definition is there isn't an accepted definition. The government hasn't defined it in that consultation. It hasn't done that in a kind of useful way. There isn't a consensus out there. And so what will often happen is we'll end up talking past one another because there are different definitions being used, different understandings of the term. Some are extremely broad and almost everything's included. It's probably one of the topics we'll return to. Some are much tighter and looking at therapies in particular. But what the government has said is a number of things in which people are asking for more clarity. What is the definition? They've come up with really a new phrase, talking conversion therapy. They've asked questions around consent and coercion and everyday practice. So government said, look, there's physical conversion therapy. That's already illegal. And they're proposing to up the punishments on that. And that's something that we would be supportive of. They've then come up with this new thing of talking conversion therapy. And they've said you can consent to that. While they don't think it's helpful or useful, adults can consent to that, and that would be allowable under the proposals. And then they said anything that's coercive would be illegal. But there's a lot of concern about how they're defining coercion because they're coming up with a new definition. And then gender identity is included within that, and there's some concerns around that. That's probably why the consultation got extended. Our position in summary, because you asked me to be, you know, from EA's perspective, look, we've consistently said, honour the two commitments you made, government. One was to ban abusive and coercive practices. That should be done. Absolutely, we're supportive of that. The other was to ensure that people can receive the spiritual support that they choose. That also should be done, and we think there's a way to find the balance in that. So we're saying, you made two commitments, honour those two commitments. That's what we're looking for as Evangelical Alliance.
That's really helpful as a summary of both the legislation as you see it and your position on it. Jane, again, would be great to hear firstly a little of your own background, because I know that your personal journey is very relevant to why you've become so committed in this particular cause of banning gay conversion therapy. And just, yeah, what your overall position is on what the government are proposing.
Thank you, Justin, and thank you. I echo Peter's thanks for hosting this programme and allowing us to explore what are deeply complex, but also actually at the core of it, quite simple truths, which is what we're trying to do is protect vulnerable people from harm and allow a gospel of love to be embraced and shared amongst those who've oftentimes felt excluded. Now, I, as you've pointed out, have been through conversion therapy myself. I put myself voluntarily, I consented. I would currently not be covered by the government's proposals because I willingly thought that the right thing to do was to subject myself to years, ultimately about 20 years of prayer. I talk about it being in three phases often, the private phase where you yourself carry this terrible burden of knowing that who you are is someone who's attracted to someone of the other sex, but you feel that that is incompatible with your faith because that's what you've been taught and that's what you know everyone around you believes too. And ultimately something often happens. In my case, I had a full-blown breakdown. Other people are often outed. And I moved into what I call stage two, where I ask and reach out for people to pray for me, often within my prayer group at church, but also prayer ministries. I sought out counselling and help and support. This is done in love. You know, I think one of the fallacies that we need to break is that people who are practicing are doing it because they really, truly want someone to be healed. They're doing it for all the right reasons. But that doesn't take away from the fact that actually what is happening is harm is being caused, and deep psychological harm, because people like myself are left with the guilt and the shame that the prayer isn't working. They believe that God has abandoned them. There is deep sense of feeling inadequate as a Christian because you don't have enough faith for this to work, that there must be something wrong with your walk with God. And so much of the teaching is about the fact there must be some deep hidden sin that is stopping God from intervening and curing you or helping you find peace. And ultimately for me, I ended up in hospital a second time because I'd gone through what I call the third stage of seeking out far more intrusive forms like deliverance ministries and exorcisms, people with specialist ministries where I paid an awful lot of money to people, again, in love, trying to help me become straight or find a way of carrying the burden of being celibate for life. Now, that is why I took a motion to the Church of England in 2017, and the Church of England fully backed a call to ban conversion therapy from the government. We then ran some research in the UK, which echoes now the government's own research that showed the vast majority of conversion therapy that's happening in the UK today is happening in religious settings. This is not, as Peter has said, something that the church is historically, well, I mean, they have been historically guilty of, but they are guilty of today. And one of the things I find really so difficult, and I do want to talk to Peter about, is their refusal to recognise now the hundreds, if not thousands, of testimonies of LGBT people who, in a religious setting, have had their lives ruined. And indeed, our research shows that, you know, a third have committed, tried to commit suicide. Two thirds have had suicidal thoughts. We don't know the number of people who've taken their lives, but many of us know individuals who have. This is a really serious problem, which the evangelical church and indeed parts of the Catholic Church have refused to engage with. And it's that is why we need the government to intervene. We have got an international definition on conversion therapy. I know you want to come on to those practicalities. What I'd say about where the government have made commitments, they've committed to banning religious practices. The letter from the Prime Minister to Peter was quite clear that appropriate pastoral care would be allowed. But appropriate is not causing harm. And that means that we want to willingly and embrace prayer that seeks to bring someone, I've always said this, allow someone to a point of peace, but does not try to change or suppress or cure who they are. That is inappropriate and causes harm. And that's where the debate has to focus.
Yeah, well, this is obviously the key issue, isn't it, about what constitutes appropriate pastoral care, what would or would not harm a person, even if they have consented to prayer or any kind of pastoral care. I mean, Peter, perhaps you could respond both to Jane's story and this criticism, which she has levelled elsewhere as well, that she doesn't feel the EA UK have acknowledged the many stories of people who say that they have suffered at the hands of abuse and churches that haven't been able to, that essentially have engaged in some form of this kind of therapy.
Yeah, I mean, I find that surprising, given that Jane's just referenced the Prime Minister's letter in which we acknowledge. So our first public intervention was to say that we're deeply concerned that some of the practices have been carried out, to recognise the role of the church. This is literally the second, third paragraph of the letter, having established who we are. The church has sadly played historically this role. It has perpetuated stigma, discrimination, harm towards people because of their sexuality, and we oppose those abusive practices. I've done a number of interviews in which we've acknowledged that. That's consistently been our position. And so I did find it quite bizarre and strange, and I don't want to go...
Sorry, Jane, what did you want to say?
Yeah,
you
wanted to come in on that. By his own admission, he's used the word historic. And I said that that's what he's admitted, historic. But it's happening right now, today, in a church, in London, in Oxford, in Manchester, around the country, because of the EA's teaching. They've got it on their website about what they advise people should, church leaders should do with LGBT people. And it's that teaching right now, today, is causing huge amounts of harm. And it's that, Peter, that I'm trying to get you to recognise is still causing harm. And you won't. You'll talk about the past.
That's, Let's hear your response, Peter. Go ahead.
I mean, we've got a long form conversation. So, you know, we've said we're deeply concerned at some of the prices. So that's ongoing. And then we also recognise the historic pace. So we have to do both those things. So there's a move there then to an accusation that there's something that we're doing right now. And that's the bit, you know, so you've got a pinned tweet up there saying, look, the EA do this and this. So the headline of your current article is Evangelical Alliance, quote, loving unorthodox or, quote, damaging and dangerous.
And
the article itself actually doesn't mention the Evangelical Alliance, not a single time in the article. So the headline has the clickbait piece at the top,
actually,
and then there's no mention of the Evangelical Alliance in it. So I do think at this moment there's a really important integrity conversation. I'm happy to let you, I mean, I think we've got plenty of time to come back and forward.
Terribly useful to this conversation to try and nitpick on those. What I am saying is you're teaching, Peter, and those of evangelicals around you, and you yourself, is causing so many young people to consider taking their lives. And you should be ashamed of that. But more importantly, as a Christian and a pastor, you should be deeply concerned about the impact of that teaching. And there is no evidence in the gospel of Jesus teaching something that is going to cause people harm. In fact, completely the opposite. He calls out religious leaders, and that's what I do in my article, when they are putting people in places which will cause them to carry burdens that they can't.
Okay,
so I do think we've got really, but
let's allow Peter an opportunity to respond. Yeah, a more length now to what you said there,
John. The allegations are really important because I absolutely am gospel centered on this, but there's a truth moment in this. What I don't want is some sort of technical. Oh, well, I put it in it. So the allegations against Evangelical Alliance, the article headlines that, no mention of Evangelical Alliance in it. We've had, Jane, you tweeted and said, look, Peter Lyons goes on record saying he's worried he can't continue to practice CT. At least now we have proof and admit conducting it. And then that tweet was immediately pulled down. No apology, because it was incorrect. So we've got to be really careful in the engagement that we say things that are true, that we can stand over. I think there's enough ground where we disagree and we can do that with integrity. What I don't want is the misleading of people that Evangelical Alliance is in a headline of an article and we're not referencing it. Let's talk about the stuff we've actually said and engaged with. Let's talk about the kind of change. We do disagree theologically. I'm not looking to harm people, but what we are looking to do is have a conversation about sexuality, about what the biblical text says, and about what churches can do around discipleship.
But the
what
evidence
we're also saying is you can't do behaviours that are going to cause harm, but we have to find a balance between those two things. And we've been very clear in asking the government. There are other groups that are saying you don't need any law. Let's not have any legislation. The Evangelical Alliance had looked at this. We've listened to groups. We've talked to True Freedom Trust. We've talked to Living Out. We've talked to David Bennett and others who've written into this case. You and I have engaged a lot on this. I'm very happy to let you come. There's two ways we can do the conversation.
I will come to you in just a moment, Jane, for responses on all of this. But yeah, let's just allow Peter to finish his.
You put quite a number of allegations against Evangelical Alliance specifically, so I'm coming back on those and saying we've got to do the conversation with integrity and truthfulness. You can't say things that simply aren't true or you're not going to back up. I think there's plenty of areas we can disagree with well and have that conversation. I'm absolutely rooted in the gospel conversation. What did Jesus say about sexuality and ethics? What does discipleship look like? What is the core of the gospel around conversion, change, metanoia, and transformation? And then how do we do discipleship well with good guidelines, good engagement with government, and rules that protect the vulnerable but allow freedom of religion in this space and people to choose the kind of care that they want?
Okay, Jane, go ahead.
Well, I think listeners can hear that Peter's calling me a liar, which I think is quite unfortunate. Truthfulness is very much at the core of what we do. And the truth, Peter, is that your website, Evangelical Alliance, tells people in your pastoral principles to put people out of the churches, that they have to repent, that they have to change. And that, it's on your website, so this is not untruthful. But, you know, look at the harm, the testimonies, the government research, the UN research, the Ozan Foundation research, the stories that are put on the media almost daily now of people whose lives have been absolutely turned upside down, of young people who have tried to take their lives because of your teaching. And until you embrace and acknowledge that, we will have to continue to use the law to hold you to account, because this is spiritual abuse in its worst form. And people consent, in inverted commas. In fact, most legal lawyers who I'm working with saying there is no grounds for informed consent when people have been brought up in an area where the cost of not consenting is so high. We see it amongst the Evangelical Alliance itself. When any evangelical stands up and says, we don't agree, that we believe that the gospel actually is being misinterpreted and has been. But if you go back to the Greek and the Hebrew and look at actually what Jesus said on sexuality, zero. You know, there's been such mistreatment. And yet when people stand up and say that, they are put outside. Look how you treated Steve Jobs. Look at how you treated Ruth Gilson Webb. You are an echo chamber where you only accept those who conform to your teaching.
Let's come back to Peter at this point. I mean, lots of things raised there, Peter. I mean, I'd be interested in firstly what your view is of the way Jane characterizes the specific teaching of the EA in this area to churches, and whether you believe what you do, in fact, say and advise does fall foul in any way of this current legislation, that it would be a problem for the way that churches, you know, under the Evangelical Alliance are being advised to care for people who are LGBT in their congregation. So, yeah, just some responses.
Yeah, I think, again, really important. So can we disagree theologically, biblically, on what the Bible says? The paradigm for that, so I remember having conversations with people, my good friend Podrick, who was gay, and was saying, so what was the key text, Peter? And I said, we were there for a different conversation, but I said, I'll always go back to Genesis 2, to the creation text, we're made male and female, so the first earthling or human being is made, from which we get the male and the female, and then a man leaves his mother and his father and goes to be with his wife, and we see a paradigmatic or framework text. Now, I can see you say, I'm not saying everybody has to agree, but that's the framing text. You can build a whole series of texts through that in the Old Testament. Jesus then affirms marriage in Matthew 19. He makes a number of references to porneia, to sexual immorality that we've been well understood to include anything outside of marriage. And then there are a number of other key texts that we're familiar with in terms of Romans, 1 Corinthians, Timothy. And when you put those all together, that's a pretty consistent set of texts. And lots of other people have written about that. There's lots of theological work people can go off and do their digging. I think that's a coherent position. I think it's the biblical position. I'm aware that others take a different view. But I think we should be able to talk about that in robust ways. That's probably the position. It's been the position historically, the last 2,000 years, by the majority of the church. It's still the position of the majority of the church globally to understand those texts in that way. It's not an unusual position. And then in terms of the affirmations that are built on that, they don't demand that people are treated in particular ways. In fact, they set out quite clearly, but I'm not going to run away from the church discipline point is there. Is that something that can be done if somebody steps outside the bounds of marriage? Yes, it is. If somebody has an affair with somebody else, church discipline may come in, but it's not prescribing it. What it's saying is that churches may choose to follow that pathway, and that's got to be something that's open to them. Well, if somebody has an affair and somebody in a church says, if you're not prepared to move away from that, is that an area where church discipline can come into play? Many churches believe it is. They believe they're following the biblical text in that. And that's the simple, that's what those affirmations are looking at, something like that. So I think we again have to have the space to have that conversation and say, can we read the text in different ways? Is there a majority historical reading over the years and across the globe? Yes, there is, that has looked towards marriages between one man and one woman. And that's the place for sexual practice. Because I think one of the things where we're going to cross a little bit is around practice and changes in practice and how we respond to that and changes in sexual orientation. So a lot of the work that's done is around practice and speaking into that space.
So Peter's rightly pointed out that there are very differing views on scripture, and we could, if you want, Justin, unpack all those now. I'd say that the core text is God is love, and anything that harms a child of creation or an adult of creation goes against that love. And yes, we may have made a teaching for thousands of years, although I don't think you'll find the teaching on marriage has been for thousands of years. It's been a couple of hundred years, and you need to do your homework on that. And indeed, a lot of the unpacking of that Greek and Hebrew is much more recent than you think it is, Peter. But when it causes harm, and when that harm is shown and proved and people have embraced it and seen it, then we need to respond to it. And this is not about having affairs out of marriage. This is about telling somebody who is intrinsically attracted to someone of the opposite sex or is trans, i.e. that they feel that their body that they're born into does not match what they know themselves to be, saying that that who they are is wrong and must be confined to a very narrow understanding, a historic understanding that's caused so much harm, is I think, spiritual abuse in its worst form. And that's why we need laws to protect people. Frankly, if Peter and others were able to admit to the harm and the people and sit down and listen, although people have tried to write to them, tell them what the outcome has been of sitting under these teachings, then I hope they would weep and that they would apologise and repent for what they have done. But there is this blindness, this stubbornness, this arrogance, that this narrow interpretation of scripture is something that they feel that they have to stick to. And one has to ask,
let's hear a response
honest,
then.
And you have to ask why. Why are they so keen to cling, despite all the evidence and all the theological teaching now that shows that actually Genesis 2 is about the fact that it's not good for man to be alone and that there was nothing in the garden, in the created order, that was of his same species? And what we see there is the first picture of what it is to see someone and love someone. Peter wants to focus on sex. I want to focus on what it is to love and be loved and to celebrate that beautiful gift that God gives us as human beings.
So I think, I mean, we can caricature each other all day. I don't think that's particularly helpful. I'm not focusing on sex. I was asked to go back to those passages. It deals with two things. It deals with biological sex because it does actually separate them out into male and female. It's really clear on that. So the first earthling separated into the Ish and the Isha, the male and the female. That's the biological sexed beings. And then those two sexed beings are brought back together into one. I mean, there's a symmetry to the text and the way it's put together.
You
we have an hour, as I understand it. Let's
allow Peter to finish his point and we'll go to a break. I'm aware that we could spend the whole show debating the theology. Now, I'm aware that what I want to come back to as soon as we can really is more the legal aspects of this, because I just accept that you both take very different perspectives on the theology of sexuality from the Bible. But finish your thought, Peter. We'll go to a quick break. And then
so
we'll
absolutely, God
to
is the God of love, bringing those two things together. That's what's mirrored in that. That's where the creational texts are taking us repeatedly again and again, the bringing together of the male and the female. And the fall in Genesis 3 just reflects that again. It's male and female, and that's incredibly important to the text. And it comes throughout the bride of Christ, the bringing together as we look towards the future. The male and female is intrinsic to our understanding of the text. God is love is at the heart of that. I absolutely agree. I don't think it's helpful to caricature each other as if we're not people of love. It's how we understand that love to be expressed. John 1 is, if you love me, you obey my commands. So that love leads into the behavior and obedience. And people who say you are wrong, who you are is wrong. I have not said that. I don't endorse that. I don't back that. We do have differences about what that leads to, how we live our lives out of that. If you say fundamentally who you are is wrong, that's deeply problematic. I agree with you there, Jane. Let's be really clear on that. I'm not supporting that. You'll not find that in Evangelical Alliance's teachings. What you will see is we say, what does the discipleship journey look like in response to that? And that's a very different thing.
And at that point, we're just going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about gay conversion therapy. There is legislation on the books to ban it and for certain aspects of pastoral care to come under consideration. There's currently a consultation with the public. There are links to both my guests, Peter Linus and Jane Ozan, with today's show, where you can find both of their perspectives and indeed the guidelines as well that are being proposed. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's show. We're debating, should gay conversion therapy be banned? Peter Linus and Jane Ozan join me. Peter Linus from the UK Evangelical Alliance has concerns about the scope of proposals from the government, the possible criminalisation of certain kinds of pastoral care for same-sex attracted people in churches that do take a traditional view on sexuality and gender. Jane Ozan is part of the Ban Conversion Therapy Coalition. She believes this is an essential piece of legislation, potential legislation, to help ensure LGBT people are protected from harm in religious settings. And both the EA and the Ban Conversion Therapy Coalition have been encouraging people to go and express their opinions. The deadline is the 4th of February for this consultation. So, again, we've sort of been over some of the theology there, Jane, but ultimately it's a very real world, if you like, concern that you have, isn't it? And maybe just explain why, for you, this legislation is essential, because you obviously believe there have been real consequences to the kind of teaching of that more conservative theology in churches. And again, reiterate what you said for me earlier, because I think this is quite a key issue, is you think that it's not just about consent, because ultimately the kind of teaching you sit under, perhaps as a young person for many years, is going to inevitably affect the kinds of decisions you make around sexuality and gender.
Yes, I think my position is that you can't have informed consent, and that all forms of conversion therapy are by their very definition coercive, because they come from a point of view of saying who you are is unacceptable or sinful, or that you feel ashamed of who you are because of the environment that you grow up in. And therefore you try and seek a way out. And in trying to put yourself through that change, and to find people who want to do that. And I mean, the truth is, about in our country, there are more people who are volunteering, but there are people who are forced. And there are, sadly, many young people who are forced by their parents or their religious leaders to go through this. And that is clearly wrong. But where the debate at the moment, if you like, in the public square is whether informed consent should be allowed. And lawyers will say that you cannot consent to abuse. You cannot consent to anything that is degrading, inhumane, or indeed torture. This is called Article 3 under the Human Rights Convention. And the legal opinion will be that because there is such great evidence now of harm, not just with our own studies, but the government's own research, the UN's research, the work of the psychological, psychiatric professions who together have come together and said how harmful this is. Because there's such clear evidence of harm, and because it is based on discrimination against lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people, that is why it takes it to the threshold of being inhumane and degrading treatment, and therefore must be banned under what we call Article 3. And that will therefore impinge, and rightly impinges, on people's freedom of religion and freedom of expression. And we can get to that later.
And so just for a sense of the clarity on this, Jane, for you, would that mean, for instance, that to offer prayer to someone who is same-sex attracted, encouraging them to live a celibate lifestyle and not to engage in same-sex behaviour, that for you would constitute a form of abuse and fall within the scope of religious conversion therapy?
So it's important to be clear, and I agree with Peter on definitions here. So if I may, just for a minute, I'll set out what I believe the definition should be, which is any practice or anything that is done, not necessarily thought processes, but anything that is done, practice, that seeks to change, cure, or suppress a person's sexual orientation or gender identity. And in the case of religious practices, what we recommend is the test of what we call a predetermined purpose. So any practice that is done with a predetermined purpose, intention by the person doing it, to change, cure, or suppress. And so, yes, that would include someone who is asking to become celibate. That is different to pastoral care. Okay, so I believe passionately, and as a Christian who's gay, I want all the prayer I can get to live a wholesome, peaceful life. I believe passionately in the importance of pastoring people so that they can come to a point of peace. The importance is there's no predetermined outcome, that, you know, whoever you are, whatever you believe you need to do, how you live your life, that that is good and right and is the right role of the pastor. But when they are forcing or telling people with a predetermined purpose, I hope I'm making this clear, that is where the danger lies. And that is what needs to be criminalised.
Okay. Peter, a response to that sort of perspective then on the specifics of the kinds of activity, prayer that Jane envisages as being harmful and should be banned?
Well, I mean, the government has proposed consent. I think that's important to understand. They've said throughout they will ban the coercive element because that's the bit that would be illegal. The Article 3 torture piece is, I think we need to be really careful of that. The government can't propose something that would be in breach of that. A number of QCs have looked at that. There are two opinions in the public domain that are very clear. Nothing that's being proposed here is anything close to the threshold of Article 3 and torture. That's a very specific piece of legislation. The UN's not alleging that either. So if Jane has a piece of evidence specifically says that this legislation will fall foul of Article 3, that would be great to read, because that's not in the public domain. So we need to set that bit. That's why consent's in play. The UK government could not propose consent if they thought this was even close to that threshold, and it's not. So that's why we have the consent piece. And the consent piece is really important because if you choose, and we did a YouGov poll, and that polling shows 58% of people think people should be able to choose what sort of support and help they have in relation to their sexual orientation or gender identity. If you choose that support, you must be free to do it. And the government's saying that, that you can do that. So somebody like Andrew Bunt, who's written about his own experiences, his involvement with Living Out, says as he as a teenager came through, became aware of his sexual orientation and what he was going to do about that, he asked for prayer and he had a predetermined outcome and he asked the other person to pray with him in a particular way. That would potentially be illegal, particularly if he was under 18. But he's saying, hold on, I'm consenting. And the person who's praying for me has the predetermined outcome that I want them to have. I'm choosing this. I'm engaging together. So that's what would fall foul of this legislation. And that's really problematic because what it means is, and Ed Shaw has written about this too. He said, Ed can't get the support that he needs in this moment because the person would be praying with his consent to suppress his desires as a same-sex attracted man who wants to live celibately. I would be committing a criminal offence if I prayed with him under some of what's being proposed under these definitions. The banned conversion therapy definition, Jane's definition. The banned conversion therapy definition, which Jane's involved, was the most difficult and problematic because it talked about persuading people to change their behaviour to a heteronormative lifestyle. So if Dave Bennett, who wrote a wonderful book, A War of Loves, gets up and tells his story, and somebody says, oh, in response to that, I'm going to change, I've been persuaded by your story, David, to change my behaviour, he commits a criminal offence even if he doesn't know the person's changed his behaviour. And so that what that leads to is the banning of people telling their stories if their stories encourage or persuade somebody to suppress their behaviour. That's just reading down through Jane's definition, because what you've done is you have encouraged somebody to suppress and change their behaviour. And that's really problematic because you're banning Ed, you're banning David, and you're banning Andrew from telling their story.
Okay. This is where we obviously get to the nuts and bolts of what it means to suppress or persuade or whatever it may be. Jane, you obviously feel that that's not a fair reading of your...
No, I didn't use the word persuade in that definition, Justin, that I write you. And all that we've done is published in the Cooper Report, which has brought together some of the country's top senior international human rights lawyers. And they've published a 7 paper on consent and the problems of informed consent. And what
persuade came from banned conversion therapy, as I said, just to be clear, which is an organisation you support.
Okay. Yes. The three words you used were change, cure, or suppress, Jane. That's the definition you're wanting to give today. But Peter, are you saying that there is more definitions in the banned conversion therapy?
Yes, it uses the word persuade, and Jane's chair of that. So I was going back to that. But if that's changed, that's useful to know.
We've been digging in the past. This is what we've put clearly to government. That's what we've been saying for the last 6 months, 9 months since we've been engaged with the government's consultation. I think the important thing here is that the predetermined purpose of trying to not just generally give a story to a whole group of people, it's when it's directed at an individual with a predetermined purpose of trying to change or suppress them. And it rightly should be banned because it causes such harm. And if you read Ed Shaw's book, you will see the harm it's caused him. He talks about his kitchen floor moments when he's racked with pain and loneliness. And that is what takes 99% of the people who you teach that to, Peter, over the edge, who leave their churches, who leave their faith, but more importantly, have mental health issues for life. And that is why we have to change it, because you are causing, without wanting to recognize it, such deep trauma and harm. And it is spiritual abuse. I know it's done in love, and it's because you think it's the right thing to do, but it is harmful and wrong, and you must be held to account. And until you, you know, this whole interview,
Jane's now just making numbers up.
Well, let's allow Jane to just finish, and then I'll come back to Peter. Yes, go ahead, Jane.
It's really important. The government have actually said this is a consultation because they want to hear about informed consent. In fact, they've met with the lawyers to understand that you can't have informed consent when you have an Article 3 issue. And that's why no other country has... Other countries have looked at this. Canada, New Zealand, Australia, all the main countries who've done this recently have not allowed any loophole whatsoever, because they recognise how harmful this is. And in fact, you know, we don't have informed consent for wearing seatbelts. We don't have informed consent on female genital mutilation or forced marriage, because we know that the whole point is to protect people, and that the environment in which they are being brought up in is coercive and discriminatory. And that's...
So to some extent, it sounds, Peter, that whatever concerns you may have over the religious freedom aspect of this, it's outweighed by the harm that potentially is happening to people who, you know, even with the best intentions, are actually being abused or experiencing harm in these situations.
There was a 99% statistic put in there. So basically what Jane said is she knows better what harm Ed suffered than Ed has. So Ed has written about a story, and I think I'm happy to let Ed speak for himself on that. And he has put his views in specifically on this piece of legislation. And he is supportive of the you know, where the government's going in terms of the two aims that we've expressed. And we work quite closely with him on that. So I think the 99% is just... there's no statistics to back that up on the 99%.
Survey report, is it?
Let's come back to this though, Peter. I mean, obviously, this is at the center of what Jane's saying is, regardless of the percentage, what she says, there are lots of people who are harmed. And as far as she's concerned, even this informed consent does not protect those people. However you frame it, it's going to hurt people in the long run, and better to be safe than sorry.
Are that somebody like Ed can't get the support that he's choosing and wanting. The implications are that Andrew Bunt can't get the support that he wants. To do that, you remove any option for people to choose the support that they want. That's why Germany, for example, does have consent. It's why other countries have looked at consent. And again, I want to push home this point. This is not an Article 3 point. Show me a legal opinion that says what's being proposed by the UK government fall of Article 3. That creed.
Can I just, because I'm not as familiar with these terminologies as you both, reiterate what Article 3 is? And
Article 3 is the European Convention of Human Rights.
Okay,
that is why we published the Cooper Report. And if you read it, you'll know that all the lawyers who put, and including the QCs, far more QCs than the one you've rolled out.
Therein lies the key, Justin. So it can be in certain circumstances at the most extreme end. That is because it includes physical acts of conversion therapy. And that's agreed and clear. But I asked specifically about the UK law.
Okay, let's allow Peter to respond.
About the UK law. The Cooper Report
predates
the UK consultation. The two QCs' opinions that are out there, these aren't from Christian QCs. It's Jason Cobble's one and Philip Haver's QC have looked specifically at the legislation in other parts of the world and said, do any of these trigger an Article 3 right? And they're consistent that it doesn't. It's a very important claim. That's a claim to make around torture. So at the most extreme level,
it's inhumane.
What we're talking about, isn't that. So prayer for somebody, therapies doesn't meet the definition of torture.
It does, Peter, because it looks... I'm sorry. Okay. We're going to disagree on that.
Go ahead, Jane. Okay. Why for you does...
One, she's continuing to interrupt.
Let's allow Jane to... Okay. Let's allow Jane to explain why she believes that it does constitute a form of torture when even the talking therapy...
Article 3 is about inhumane, degrading and or torture. And why I explained at the start of this section is that because it meets Article 3 because it is discriminatory in a way, because it's based on a discrimination against sexual orientation and gender identity, and because of the level of harm that it is known to cause. And those two together, and you can read this various case law, will take it into the threshold of inhumane and degrading at a minimum. Now, yes, there are, sadly, evidence of violent rape, of physical beatings, of torture, of people being burnt, of people being whipped. But I agree that that is not the most common form. But the mental anguish that is and the harm that that is caused based on discrimination takes it into inhumane and degrading treatment. And the Cooper report sets that out very clearly. It's signed by a large number of QCs, including Baroness Helena Kennedy and Robin Allen and many other human rights lawyers. And I think, yes, they, Philip Havers could look at it. I don't think Philip had seen the whole, if I can be honest, I don't think he's seen Dr. Ilias Trispiotis's pieces. I don't think he was given all the evidence. But that will be something that the government is listening to both sides on. And that will be tested in the House of Lords when we pass this legislation.
So coming back to you, Peter, to just explain why for you this is pivotal to get this right, this question of whether the talking therapy triggers, if you like, this Article 3 or whatever it was that covers these kinds of issues.
Yeah, Article 3 covers torture, and where I think Jane and I undoubtedly agree is you cannot legislate for torture. UK government cannot allow torture to occur. That often applies in a way a prison system happens. It's like something like waterboarding. Even if you wrote legislation to say, we, the government, think this is okay, the European Court would say, no, you can't do that. So there, I think, is where we're aligned. The UK government has proposed and put out this consultation at the minute. There's no, I wasn't aware that anybody was actually claiming it. The consultation could potentially be in breach of Article 3. And I don't think that's a serious case of what's proposed at the minute. And that proposal includes consent to talking conversion therapies. Now, we may disagree with it, but the government has a definition of consent. It's pulled it from other legislation. It's very widely accepted legally. You can consent to all sorts of things I might disagree with. That's the reality of the world in which we live, and consent is very important. So what the government is saying is, we're going to ban the physical acts. They're already illegal. It went through all the legislation and worked out what was already illegal and said we're going to up the sentences. Quite right too. It says you're going to have the space for talking conversion therapies. They say they don't agree with them. They're not necessarily convinced by them. But people have to have the freedom to make that choice in our society. And so they're saying, as long as somebody consents, and that's a free person who can make the choice, you can do that. And they've looked at whether you can do that if you're vulnerable. No, you can't. Under 18, no, you can't. But anybody else can give informed consent. It's a fairly well understood idea, and you can do it to all sorts of concepts. And that's what they're currently proposing. And the reason is, just to finish that point, and I'm very happy to hear, is because if you don't do that, you end up discriminating against those who are same-sex attracted. You end up discriminating against Ed Shaw, Andrew Bunt, and anybody else who wants to get support of the type that they want. And it ends up bumping into both religious freedom, personal choice, and discriminating against the very people. Because you're going to end up treating gay people differently than you treat straight people. Because they can come and get counselling for anything they want, straight people. But gay people can't get it if they have a predetermined outcome, even if they choose it, and the minister's clear. That will fall foul of Jane's definition if they want help to suppress and live celibately on a predetermined outcome. Then on Jane's definition, it's conversion therapy, and both they and I would be guilty of a criminal offence. And I think actually quite a lot of people listening will think, that doesn't make sense if the people have made that choice freely to enter into that.
Okay.
Thank you. So informed consent is something, as I've said, the government are seeking for input and concern. You know, we have expressed our concerns about it. But more importantly, I think legal opinion is clear. And if you want to read about that, you can go to my website and you'll see the additional page that we've launched about informed consent. I think the interesting thing is we asked a barrister who has to prosecute a lot of hospital cases where there's been, if you like, mistreatment, where people are given consent to an operation. And if you just think in practice, what does this mean? So when you go for an operation, you're taken to one side and you have to, by law, be taken through various things. You have to be told what's the success rate of the person about to do that operation is what the consequences of you not going through that operation is. You have I can't remember all the other, but there's about six different things. Mm. If you think of that in the case of conversion therapy, there is no statistic to say what the success rate of someone is. There is no statistic to say what the impact would be if you don't go through it. The actual concept of informed consent is actually legally impossible to enforce, and that's the view of the QC who's been involved with us on this work. It is ridiculous to think that you will be able to uncoercively sign that, because basically you will trust the person in authority over you. Your religious leader will tell you, I need you to consent to me doing this prayer. Oh, yes, sir, yeah, of course I will. Because you believe that is the right thing. And that is the coercive bubble you are in. And that's why it's going to be impossible for the law courts to actually unpick informed consent. One of the things that we said to the government is that it will put the judges in a really difficult position to try and work out whether religious leaders gave informed consent or didn't. And it would be much clearer, cleaner, and frankly protect far more people to not allow that loophole at all. Because ultimately, what all law should do is protect the most vulnerable. And Peter's trying to make this case that there are a few people who sadly won't be able to get what they want. No, that's not true, because of course they can have the pastoral support and prayer that they need to live at peace. But what they can't do is be given stuff that will push them down a route and will take them to a place where they want to, unfortunately, feel that the only thing they can do is
Okay. Actually, significant agreement on that in terms of the informed consent, and there definitely are significant risks there. But I pushed you in a little bit just to say, how under what you're proposing can Ed or Andrew access
that?
It's illegal in what you're saying, Jean. You said suppress on a predetermined purpose. So if they come with that predetermined purpose, I have that predetermined purpose, and I pray with Ed in line with what we've just said to help him suppress his feelings to live a celibate life, I fall foul of your definition, do I not?
Yeah, because the abuse that you are pushing on them through your teaching that is abusive, that will cause them, I wish Ed was here to speak for himself, but he writes very clearly about it in his book, The Plausibility Problem, that the pain that he feels of trying to live out the life that he feels that he's been called to because of the teaching he's been under, which is spiritually abusive, is something that has caused so many others.
I think, to be fair to Ed, he doesn't call it spiritually abusive. I understand that he obviously says that it's a painful thing for him to come to terms with and so on, but I don't think he himself believes it is spiritually abusive.
If I infer that, that's not what I believe it's spiritual abuse, and what I'm saying is that he is clear about the pain.
But just to be absolutely crystal clear, we've got to the nub of this, is that to do that, even if Ed consents and I consent, Jean thinks that should be and would be under her illegal, and it would be a criminal offence for me to pastor Ed, even though he asked for it. Yeah. Just to be clear. So I don't want to misrepresent you, Jim, because I think that's the game changer. That's the moment where we just absolutely, even Ed cannot get the support
Peter,
that he wants.
I'm saying, you, Peter, of course he can pray for peace. Of course he can sit down and pray with you. But you can't pray to suppress him. That is dangerous, harmful, and you have to protect the hundreds, if not thousands, who've told you to your face in testimonies, online, through research, that is what has caused them such harm. And that is why we have to have law to protect the vulnerable and the vast majority of vulnerable people, even if a couple of people cannot get. But I'm sure you are bright enough, as is Ed, to find a way of praying, and frankly, between the two of you, you're not likely to take each other to court, are you? Although Ed, in this scenario, may, in 10 years' time, when he's had a breakdown potentially, when he's had mental anguish, look back and realise that what he was put through caused him great harm. So I think you, as a pastor, need to be wise about the way that you pray. You need to think about the impact that has. And I'm sure, because this is what we will have to unpack together, there are clear ways of being able to pray for someone in a way that gives them space, that allows them to be loved and accepted by God, and allows them to be the person that they know themselves.
Okay. A response from Peter, and then we'll go to our final.
Jane has had a very different journey than Ed, and I understand that. And I've read around both of those and have met and spent more time with Ed, for sure. And I don't want to get bogged down in a personal story, but there's an incredibly patronising tone there. Well, Ed will eventually, in 10 years, he's going to have the breakdown, and then suddenly it will all. And I just want to say, Jane, you've had a particular journey, and Ed has had a particular journey. And with respect, I have tried not to interrupt at any stage to give us both time because we've got a long form interview. Ed's had a particular journey. And what you have now been crystal clear on is you want to use your experience and journey and those of others, nobody's to then shut down the support that Ed and others needs. And what we have to do is find a pathway through the middle that does allow support for those who are choosing that pathway. And they believe they're living biblically in response to that, as do I. But what you're doing is taking your story and using that to suppress and push down Ed and his story and any support that he can get. And you've been, I mean, I've tried to really push that because I don't want to misrepresent you, but you're basically saying in a number of years, Ed's probably going to wake up and smell the coffee and work things out, and that his story is not valid at the minute. And I just think that's incredibly patronizing response to Ed.
Let's go to a scenario. In the case, there could be a scenario where in 10 years' time, there could be a case brought against him. That, if you listen back to the tape, that is what I was saying. I'm not saying that's what will happen. I was trying to use that in the legal scenario.
Okay. I think we want to continue talking, though, about this specific, about whether it genuinely will stop people who genuinely want to and consent to having prayer to suppress, let's describe it as same-sex attraction, and whether that would in practice be what happens if the legislation was passed in the form that you would like to see it passed, Jane. So we'll come back to that in a moment's time. Final part of the show coming up as we talk about gay conversion therapy, specifically, should it be banned? That's the proposals that are currently being on the table from the UK government. There's currently a consultation seeking views from the public as well. All the links to both my guests, Jane Ozanne and Peter Linus, and the consultation available from today's show. And we'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello, welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Always fun to pop up on other people's podcasts as well. And I've been in the company of the Babylon Bee over the last week or so. You can watch the interview I did with them as part of their weekly show. We'll link to that from our social media and so on over the weekend. But if you're a Babylon Bee fan, and I do enjoy the satire of the Babylon Bee website and the podcast too, then do go and check that out. I'm afraid I'm not quite the guest they had a few weeks ago, though. Elon Musk was on their show. So a lot of interesting commentary on the back of the interview they had with him as well. Coming up later on tonight here on Premier Christian Radio, on the profile, Geoffrey Donaldson, MP, leader of the DUP, talks to our head of news, Marcus Jones, and Richard Mayhew of the Nazareth Trust is Sam Hale's guest. That's also available on its own profile podcast. Next week here on Unbelievable, we're talking about the Doubters Club and asking, can a doubter find a place in church? My Christian guest will be Preston Ulmer. He's the author of The Doubters Club. He'll be in conversation with Gaia McDermott. She's an atheist who likes visiting churches, but has some problems with the whole believing thing. You're going to hear their conversation on the show next week. And just a final reminder that today's show covers sensitive issues regarding the pastoral care of LGBT people in the church, so listener and viewer discretion is advised. Well, it's been quite a lively discussion today on the show. Jane Ozanne and Peter Linus have joined me to talk about proposals from the UK government to ban gay conversion therapy. We haven't really talked in any depth either about the transgender element of this, but we can only do so much, obviously, in an hour or so of conversation. So, Jane, you've obviously throughout said what should be at the foremost is the harm potentially that LGBT plus people may suffer, that informed consent is really very difficult to kind of have in these kinds of contexts and so on. So as it stands, without outlining all the different aspects of the proposals on the table, are you broadly happy with the proposals that the government are putting, or are there things that actually you think should be tightened up, greater sort of sanctions and so on be imposed?
Well,
and so on?
I suppose I have three concerns, and I think, like Peter, I'd like to be clear about what the definition the government are proposing. I understand that they didn't want to put that in their proposals because they wanted to listen in the consultation, but they will need to do that in any legislative form. There are two major concerns for me. The first we've touched on in depth, which is the informed consent. I don't believe you can consent to abuse. I don't believe that it's legally possible. I don't believe that it's practically or indeed morally right. And we've rehearsed that. But the government has been, and we might want to unpick this, quite unclear at the moment as to what religious practices it will allow or not allow. The Secretary of State has said at the dispatch box that she will ensure that the ban includes religious practice. But in the consultation document, they talk about allowing private prayer, and they don't discuss what they mean by private. Does that mean me praying for myself? Of course, no one can intervene with that. Mm-hmm. But if it means prayer between two individuals, then that is what we know the vast form of conversion therapy is. And we must ensure that that is included in the ban. So being clear about this thorny issue of religious practice, what is, if you like, on the right side of the law and what's on the wrong side of the law, is, I think, going to be important when we move into a legislative world. But ultimately, if you allow informed consent, then all the abuse that I went through, and indeed hundreds of others, will continue. And I know that there is an ideological view that we should just allow freedom, allow people to do what they want. But the whole point of law is to protect the most vulnerable. And we know that at least a third of those going through conversion therapy are adults, so young adults between the age of 18 and 24. Often when they leave home, go to university, start getting girlfriends and boyfriends if they haven't had one before, or feel that they ought to be. And that's when their sexuality really becomes very clear to them. And that is when they often go through conversion therapy. And we must protect them. And that is sadly where the most risk of suicide is also at. So I'm adamant that informed consent is a real risk to the health of LGBT people.
Okay, so same essential question to you, Peter. What is your view on the current proposals? Do you feel that what already exists is covers what is needed, or are you happy to see some form of this proposal go through ultimately, as long as things are clearly defined?
Well, I think definition is absolutely critical, and we've said that. We have welcomed the consultation. We've said, look, more needs to be done in this area. I do think one of the issues is around research. The Westminster consultation acknowledges the lack of reliable research. They're self-selecting surveys. Sample sizes aren't always robust. That's Westminster themselves saying that. What we do know, that's just the opening of the survey, Jay, and that's what it says in the consultation. So 2% of LGBT plus respondents have undergone
people need to read what it actually says.
So just again, I don't know what,
so go ahead,
I'll try and get one sentence, but anyway, Westminster consultation acknowledges the lack of reliable research. It does that in its opening. There is a large government survey. I've read that survey. I know Jane has. I know Jane's conducted surveys. But the 2% of LGBT plus respondents have undergone conversion therapy. 51% of those received them in a faith group context. Just to put that vast majority into a context, it's 51%. It's a culture conversation as well as law that's really important. One of the things that's shifted already is the conversation. So churches are much more engaged in understanding this. Their approach is different. It's one of the reasons I both acknowledge now and historically. Historically, things were done in really unhealthy ways, and churches have absolutely moved. Organisations like Living Out and True Freedom Trust have really helped many explore same-sex attraction, how we respond to that. Jackie Hill Perry, Rosario Butterfield, David Bennett, many others have written, Ed and Sean and others from Living Out, around their experiences and helped us understand how to respond much better pastorally. So when it comes to it, definition is key, consent is key. This is consent to therapy, consent to prayer, consent to talking conversion therapy. It's not consent to abuse. You cannot consent to abuse. I agree with you in there. But the government has gone through its lawyers and proposed this. So we've got to look realistically at this. Can you consent to prayer? Yes, you can. Can you consent to therapy? Yes, you can. So we're going to have to look at the consent piece. We do. I have concerns about under 18s. I know that's one of the most difficult areas, but if I'm speaking at a youth group or a mixed range audience, if an 18-year-old comes and asks me something and a 17-year-old, my response would have to be different to each of those. If they are same-sex attracted or heterosexual and they say to me they're wrestling with porn and I start praying with them, if it's a 17-year-old who's same-sex attracted, I commit the offence. If it's an 18-year-old who's heterosexual, I'm fine. This leads to all sorts of problems in reality out in the road around religious practice. So we have concerns about consent and how that works its way out. And we have concerns about coercion. Coercion should be wrong. Coercive practices should be banned. But the government has changed the definition in this consultation from repeated set of acts and a clear definition drawn from domestic violence down to a single act. Though a single act could be coercive, but the problem is it can, years later somebody says, well, that one act was coercive. It leaves you incredibly vulnerable if you're pastoring and ministering to somebody. So what we're trying to do is find a balance. We do have to protect the vulnerable, but we also have to leave space for people to make choices, for people to be able to pray with one another, and to have the space for everyday religious practices. We think that can be struck, but we do have to do some hard work. It's too simple to say, let's cast everything out and throw others under the bus. We've got to nuance it and find a way through.
And before Jane responds, I'd just be interested in the precedent that we have seen in other countries. So, for example, I know Canada quite recently passed similar legislation. Where did that land, Peter, on this issue of informed consent? What kinds of things can you consent to under their
Canada's
legislation?
Canada's way, way out on the left. Canada's really problematic piece of legislation. They tried to bring it twice. It got stuck. And then the third time, the Conservatives, everybody just clapped their hands through it, didn't get any scrutiny. And a number of legislators are now saying, oh, that's really problematic. We didn't even look at this and do the proper checks on it. So, Jane, take a different view, I have no problem. But I think Canada and Australia and Victoria are very problematic pieces of legislation. They offer almost no protection for the variety of rights. And the number of QCs, again, Havers and Cobble have said, hold on, they would fall foul of the European Convention of Human Rights. It might be somewhat ironic for some Christians that are relying. I think that's great. Germany is much more nuanced. It does involve consent for adults. It looks at a much more medical level of intervention. So there are a number of international examples and we'll each look to different ones. I think okay. Victoria and Canada are deeply problematic. They haven't come into force, so we don't really know the practical outwork. In Canada, I think, comes in the next few weeks. Jane probably knows better. Victoria is just coming in, so we don't know how they'll hit the ground, but we think they could be very problematic.
Okay. Feel free to respond to that, Jane, and indeed to Peter's, you know, again, the concerns he's raised over the current.
Well, I think firstly, I'd just say that it is quite an old trick when you don't like the findings of researchers to try and unpick it all and try and pretend it's not there. But when you've got people telling you they've been harmed, and I really urge people to go and read the government's research. The problem is you have to have self-selecting surveys when you're looking at the LGBT community, because unless you did a census of the whole country, you can't do it any other way. And that is why we asked Professor Sir Bernard Silverman, who's one of the country's most senior statisticians, to oversee the research that we did, which he would say was equal to being peer reviewed. And we got 4,500 people responding and 468 people have been through conversion therapy. And their findings are really clear. Just Google it, you'll find it online. So that's the research. And frankly, even if it's just one person saying that they tried to take their life because of what they'd been taught and what they'd been through, I think we need to be concerned as people of Christ who love each other. In terms of the international community, I think it's very interesting that the more recent, if you like, in the last 12 months, legislation has been more and more and more robust. So yes, you get Canada very recently giving an outright ban, as you did with Australia, as you did with New Zealand, as we've got with France, Germany, which was much earlier in the process with Malta, now recognise that they've caused themselves great problems and there are people still at risk. But what we have seen, and I think Australia is a good example here, is that there have been a set up of a commission. And what we've proposed in the Cooper report, this legal report that we brought together, that we need a combination of what we call civil and criminal law. So the criminal law is the hard line where you obviously get prosecuted, where there is a clear, you know, this is wrong, and you get prosecuted, you go to prison, or you get a fine. But what you need alongside that is civil protections, where people can step in and give protection orders, where you can look at the individual and actually have a softer way of dealing with this. And that's what Australia have done with their commission. That's what we're recommending we should do. here in the UK. There's things that we can learn from internationally. Canada has gone through quickly, but they have looked at it for years. And so to say that it's on the hoof, or that the people are saying, oh, we didn't think of the consequences, it's untrue. That's what the campaigners there and the government have been working on for some time. And that's why Justin Trudeau has been so vocal about it. If you look on social media, you'll hear what he's had to say. And what we have seen are nations moving very quickly, because they, when they start to engage with this and listen to the voices of survivors, they've realised how many people are at risk now. And that's why the UK government needs to get on with this. They've been lobbied extensively by people who want to continue with this harm. But ultimately, we have to bring it in quickly in order to protect the most vulnerable in our midst.
Yeah. A quick response, Peter, and then we'll go to just final thoughts as we close out today.
Yeah, well, in terms of the legislator in Canada, it was a specific legislator, as I said. It's not untrue. I think that's one of the themes we've got to come in with a little bit more integrity into some of these conversations. Canada has put it through its different legislation in the first two rounds. So, yes, they did debate it, but the third time they didn't. And the bottom line is both Canada and Australia's legislation would fall foul of our European Convention rights, thankfully, both Articles 8, 9, 10 and 11, in terms of freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of conscience. In all likelihood, those are going to get struck down. That's a fairly widely held legal opinion. I think that's a good thing that we understand, because there has to be freedom. The convention does these strange things, like it's a wonderful device. So that we could go back and forth on that. As a barrister, I can tell you that's certainly my view, and I've looked at the law in detail on this. I understand Jane has a lot of experience from her story, but I also have a lot of legal experience and understanding. So the convention stuff's really important. And what we do need to find, one of the things you were asking, Justin, as we were emailing about this in advance, was just about finding better pathways through. The Ashurst case this week applied and appealed to very similar European convention rights. And what we've tried to do is, there shouldn't be a conflict between LGBT rights and Christian rights. We've got to find better ways to have this conversation. That case was never about a gay cake. It was about freedom of conscience, religion, belief, and compelling people in different ways. This conversation is moving to something similar. Again, compelling people to follow their faith in a particular way. Jane has a different theological view than me. She is entitled to that view. I disagree and she disagrees with me. But what we're now moving to is where Jane is looking to compel me and others like me in how we are going to pastor and minister and live our lives. I don't think that's appropriate. I think we should have the freedom to live in response to the text as we believe. We did the theological discussion. We have different outcomes from that. We should be entitled both to hold those. But what Jane's saying is, no, Ed and David and Peter Linus can't hold their view. Their view should be illegal. It should be banned. And I'm saying, no, that's not the right response. We've got to have the freedom in a plural public square to find better ways to have the conversation and to live in ways in which we can both coexist and say, you have a different view than me. That's fine. I absolutely agree on harm. That's why we support parts of this legislation. We've thought about it and we're trying to be nuanced in our response. But I disagree where you're going to say, well, throw those guys under the bus. Sort of. They just have to deal with it.
Yeah. Thank you. Final thoughts, Jane, and we'll start to
wrap. Of course we hold different views, but this is ultimately about protecting the vulnerable and particularly LGBT young people and old people from harm. And until the Evangelical Alliance recognised that harm, which Peter still hasn't done in churches today, he's talked about historic abuse, but he doesn't recognise that his current teaching causes many young and old LGBT people to consider taking their lives. And until that is acknowledged and dealt with, until the recognition that they are not showing a gospel of love to LGBT people, but discriminating against them, I think we will continue to have this sort of bumping up against each other. I think ultimately, as Christians, what we need to do is to show compassion, love, and protection for those in our care. And when we refuse to hear the voices of those crying out to us for help, then God will have something very, I think, harsh to say to us, but that's one for conscience. Ultimately, the law is clear that religious practice, religious freedom must be curtailed if harm is done. And that's why this is not in the Canadian law is not in breach of the European Convention, because there are very clear exceptions. And we are saying that this harm, which everyone knows about, frankly, most people in evangelical churches can see the impact that this teaching is having on those around them. And they want to see a world where we are safeguarded and we are safe and I would like to add celebrated.
I absolutely agree on the safeguarding and safe. But sorry, but Jane's gone to a fairly key point. We can disagree on the law all day long, and I disagree entirely with that interpretation of the Canadian piece. But there's quite a central piece in there. Logically, Jane, that has to lead to a banning of conservative evangelical teaching on sexuality and marriage. That's the only logical conclusion from what you've said. Because what you're saying is, if I can finish the question for a second.
You constantly put words in my mouth, and I'm going to
put back. But logically, I genuinely, Jane, don't understand how it can be anything. But you've just said that what the Evangelical Alliance says is discriminatory, it's hurtful, it's harmful.
It isn't.
So I'm saying, yes. So logically, just to be crystal clear, you therefore have to be calling for a ban for evangelical theology on sex and marriage.
And that's what you keep saying I am, which is why I find when you talk about...
I don't keep saying
you have, constantly. When I've written... Well, I'll send you the articles where you said that we can't preach or teach the word of God. And that is absolutely ridiculous because that is not what I'm saying. But I'm saying...
Why would you allow that when you say it's harmful?
Because I'm saying that...
Draw the distinction between that and the prayer.
I mean, Justin, do you want to come in?
Let's finish this, and then we'll finish.
I'm saying that you can't preach the gospel, which is absolutely untrue, and that's why I feel a lot about this when he says that truth is an issue. I'd say, well, go back and look at what you've constantly been accusing me of. I believe that you can have differing opinions. I don't believe that they are right ideology, but when you start practicing on LGBT people and telling them in prayer that who they are is wrong and or needs to be suppressed or changed, that is harmful, and it's the harm that needs to be, we need to be protected against. It is spiritual abuse, and we need to define spiritual abuse. For me, it's not even prayer, it's hate prayer, because it doesn't...
What I hear Peter saying, I think, Jane, is that as far as he can see, that the fact that you believe just the teaching, the holding of this theology in a church is itself harmful would then also mean that
I'm
should be banned.
Saying,
I think his concern is it's not...
There is a case for hate preaching at some point. It depends how it's held. But I understand and respect, and you think you'll read in all my blogs that I respect there is a conscience clause. I don't think LGBT people should be in those churches because I think that ultimately they find it very offensive. But that in itself is not what the ban conversion therapy legislation is about. This is about the practice aimed at an individual that seeks to change, cure, or suppress their sexual orientation and gender identity. We've been very clear about that. We've been constantly focused on that and trying to...
Final thought then, Peter, and
people will be able to listen back, but I mean, I'm genuinely just trying to... I thought you just said the Evangelical Alliance's positions were harmful in and of themselves, what was in our affirmations, and so to teach that would be harmful. I'm genuinely trying to understand the distinction. I am now confused. I haven't accused you of these things before, I don't believe, but I'm happy now, because I think you've just said the teaching is harmful. I know this is not what this legislation is about, but logically I don't understand why you say the prayer is harmful and the teaching is harmful, but I want to ban the prayer, but the teaching's okay. What am I missing? I'm confused.
Well, then pray for a bit of insight, Peter, because I think ultimately what your problem is that you're refusing to acknowledge the harm that you have caused so many people. And I think
positions.
Well, there's two things here, aren't there? It's what is the ban conversion therapy that we're focused on, and that is the practice of trying to change, cure, or suppress someone. Now, your teaching, I personally do believe it's harmful, but that is not to do with this legislation. I do think that is not godly. I don't think it's what the gospel calls for. I don't think it's Christian, actually. But then that's why I wrote the Via Media piece that I did.
I suppose Peter's question then, in a sense to you, Jane, is would you like to see similar legislation
I've been very clear about that. I think that's called freedom of expression and freedom of religion. Okay. I think it's wrong.
Okay. So to answer your question, Peter, it sounds like Jane is saying, yes, she does believe the positions and teaching is harmful, but she's not seeking legislation on that, whereas she is obviously for this type of what she would call conversion therapy, talking therapy.
So that is definitely helpful and confusing at the same time, if you like, because it's not the harmfulness of the prayers that's going to be the problem, because the theology is also harmful in the teaching. that's where the why ban one bit and say the other bit's okay. So the fear is the teaching next, or it's just illogical to separate the two bits out. I think that's an absolutely fair. So that's an observation I'll make.
It's about practice aimed at an individual with a predetermined purpose, and that is different to holding a belief. And that is, you know, that's the reality of a situation.
Oh, I know it is now, but both are harmful.
Well, we probably aren't going to get to the bottom of this one in this show, but it's been very helpful to hear both of these positions articulated, obviously passionately on both sides when it comes to conversion therapy. Now, as I mentioned, at the time of recording and broadcasting this show, it is still possible for the public to put their views across. I will give links to both the EA and the Ban Conversion Therapy Coalition so that you can read the different perspectives. I'll also put links to where both Peter and Jane have written or been interviewed by Premier Christianity magazine in recent months about these issues. And of course, a link to the consultation itself so that anyone who wishes to express their views can do so. For now, Peter and Jane, thank you very much for joining me on today's show.
Thank you.
Phew, well, hope you enjoyed that. It was a lively one. Tell us what you thought of it by emailing me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can get in touch as well via our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/premierunbelievable. There's a link from today's show to that, as well as to our other social media too. You can follow me at unbelievablejb on Twitter. I'm also over on Instagram and TikTok as justin.briley. And don't forget, it helps others to discover Unbelievable if you rate and review us in your podcast provider. So if you're able to do that, that's great. Today's show, of course, available via our YouTube channel as well. Thanks to all those who've been getting in touch with the show. It's great to hear people who have been appreciating and benefiting from the show. We're going to leave some of the bigger bits of feedback to last week's debate on miracle claims, extraordinary evidence, and that kind of thing. We'll leave that to next week's show. Just a few lovely messages, though, that I've received in the last week or two that I wanted to read out. This one from Charlie, who got in touch to say, Unbelievable is one of the best influences about in Christianity right now. I'm an agnostic atheist, but I love your content and the different perspectives. I'm also going to get your book because I really like the passion and kindness you bring. You aren't afraid to have really smart atheists on and discuss important questions. Thanks for a great show, Justin. Thank you, Charlie. Those sorts of emails absolutely make my day, because we exist for everyone on this show. So glad that you found it helpful as an agnostic atheist. And hope you enjoy the book as well. Book's still available. It's been in print now for getting on for 4 years or so. Unbelievable why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. I should really update it to 15 years now. Thank you very much. Melissa says, Dear Justin and the Unbelievable team, I've been a believer and committed follower of Christ for almost 30 years. And in 2002, my husband and I moved to a Muslim majority country to do cross-cultural spiritual work. So I was mostly out of the Western culture and Western worldview changes for the last 20 years. Of course, I would hear things and read about shifts, but my world was so focused on Islam and the people I was living among. So I'm writing to thank you for all the help your podcast has been to me as our family transitions back to the US and all the cultural and spiritual shifts which have occurred while our home was overseas. I especially was impacted and felt compelled to write after listening to the episode with Dean Mays and Dan Patterson. Of course, the openness and honesty of Dean was refreshing, but I also want to commend you and Dan in how you both explained the biblical view relating to suffering and extended the offer to Dean to try on what it would be like to live as if Christianity is true in such a gracious and winsome way. I think I'm feeling moved to write to you. I've never written to a podcast or show before, because as I transition back to my original birth culture and feeling a bit lost at sea in the changes that occurred while I was gone, this episode gave me such hope in having conversations with people like Dean in the way that you and Dan did in the podcast. Praying for your show to continue to be used by God. Thank you, Melissa. All the very best as you transition back to the US. I'm sure it'll be just as disorientating as your original move to the Middle East in 2002. Rachel says, Hello, Justin. Started listening to your podcast a couple of years ago when my teen daughter developed a chronic illness. It's been a battle to find knowledgeable doctors and to discover a diagnosis. I was raised as a Christian, but found myself feeling like my relationship with Jesus was very shallow and superficial, and your show's been a great help in strengthening my faith over the past 2 years. I'm writing because I'm interested to know what you think of the book The Discovery of Genesis. I saw someone talking about it on TikTok, and I'm intrigued. I have something in the archives of a similar topic, could you direct me to the show number? Rachel, thank you so much for the lovely words and all the very best for you and your teen daughter. Glad the show's been helpful. Have to confess, I don't know of this book, The Discovery of Genesis. I'll look it up and see. But yes, if you look through the archives, we've certainly done plenty of shows around creation, evolution, Genesis and so on. But not knowing exactly what the topic of the book is, I'm not sure which shows might be best for that. But go to the show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Or indeed go to our Podbean podcast provider. That might be the easiest way to do this. And just type in Genesis or creation or something like that, and it'll bring up all the show titles that have those in them. So go to the links with today's podcast for the Podbean, and you'll be able to do a little search there. That's all we've time for on today's show. Thank you very much for being with me. And I hope you enjoyed it. Hope it was edifying in some way, and that you'll be able to get in touch with me to tell me what you think about this issue. As we said, the consultation is open until the 4th of February on this conversion therapy bill. For now, thanks for being with us, and we'll see you next time. And next time is a conversation between a Christian and an atheist, the Doubters Club. We're asking, can a doubter find a place in church? Preston Ulmer, author of the Doubters Club and also the person who founded the organisation that brings Christians and sceptics and atheists together for conversation. He's going to be in conversation with Gaia McDermott, who's an atheist who likes churches, likes visiting them, but has some problems with the whole believing thing. Hear their conversation, really interesting one for you. Same time next week. For now, thanks for being with us.